questions about NASA's budget and its leader, plus a look at Starship's latest flight. You're listening to Are We There Yet?, the radio show exploring space exploration. Hi, I'm Brendan Byrne. The Trump administration released a more detailed budget plan for NASA, cutting nearly 24% of the space agency's funding. While it still has to be approved by Congress, it's raising concerns for science advocates now, like the Planetary Society's Casey Dreyer. We speak with him about this proposal and how it may shape NASA's future. Then, who will be the next NASA administrator? President Trump rescinded his nomination of Jared Isaacman. Ars Technica's Eric Berger joins us to talk about that developing story, plus a look at SpaceX's latest Starship test flight. That's ahead on Are We There Yet? A budget proposal from the White House would cut about a quarter of NASA's budget and cut key science missions if approved by Congress. That's according to the Trump administration's recently released budget request. That includes cuts to missions like Juno at Jupiter and New Horizons, which is now beyond Pluto. Science advocates are calling this an extinction-level event for the space agency's most productive, successful, and broadly supported activity, science. Here to talk more about the budget plan and how it will impact the space agency is Casey Dreyer. He's the chief of space policy for the Planetary Society, a science advocacy organization. Casey, welcome back to the show.
Thanks for having me.
Hey, Casey, the last time we talked, this budget was in its proposal stage, is the so-called skinny budget. What is different with what we know now?
We know all the grisly details of the implications of cutting NASA's budget by 25% and NASA science by 50%. So it's not just theoretical. Individual missions are all, you know, named, which ones will be canceled mid-flight. We know how much workforce NASA has proposed to lose. It's just pretty grim across the board.
You say grisly details. Let's dive into those. You said mission cancellations. What is off the board based upon this budget?
This budget cancels about a third of NASA's entire science portfolio, including 19 active in-flight space missions, missions that are giving good data right now, operating for functional pennies on the dollar for the taxpayer. Projects like Juno at Jupiter, New Horizons in the Kuiper Belt, multiple Mars missions, a number of Earth science missions, and of course, you know, things like the Chandra Space Telescope. So things you can't make or just purchase or put back in place again, functionally worth about, you know, $12 billion of past taxpayer investment. We see the spigot of future missions functionally turned off, with nearly every single future science mission in development canceled. And then, of course, major, you know, ramping down, ending the SLS and Orion programs, canceling the Gateway Space Station, ending NASA's education and outreach program entirely, and then roughly laying off about a third of NASA's remaining workforce.
That's staggering. Going back to one of the first things you mentioned is those kind of flagship missions that are being canceled, like the Juno probe to Jupiter. I mean, that launched in 2011. It arrived at Jupiter in 2016. That's a big loss of time and effort and money if that's canceled, right?
The amount of money we spend to operate it at this point is just a couple million dollars a year out of NASA's 20-ish billion dollar budget. And, you know, these types of extended missions, they go through very rigorous scientific review every few years to ensure that they're still giving us good data. Obviously, there's not like a ton of missions at Jupiter right now. In fact, it's the only spacecraft at Jupiter right now. It's flying by the Jovian moons. It's giving us unique views and just beautiful images. And usually, you know, you want to run this until it's down and out. It's like running your car into a ditch because you want to save money on gas. You can, yeah, sure, you save a few pennies, but at the end of the day, you don't have a car anymore to drive. You've lost a foundational capability you did not have before.
Another one, New Horizon, which has flown past Pluto, I mean, years ago, and is in the Kuiper Belt now. I mean, we don't have spacecraft that far, or many spacecraft that far away. I mean, that is quite a bit of scientific data that stands to lose, right?
Absolutely. And it's, again, it's not just if you canceled it, turned it off and let it spin into oblivion, and then it's like, oh, we want to discover, you know, figure out what's in the Kuiper Belt again. It's not just that you have to rebuild it. You have to take 20 years to get where you're going. It's some of these things that it takes, you know, space is big. There's a lot of space in space. And once you're there, you want to, again, get every dollar possible, bring every piece of data, every piece of science out of these things possible to maximize the value to the taxpayer investment. These are not running over budget. You know, they're running very reliably. They are providing good, valuable science. It's a wasteful, to put it in the modern parlance, it's wasteful and inefficient to turn these off midstream.
You mentioned there could be personnel, or there will be personnel cuts with this budget. Can we quantify that? Do we know how many people will be affected by this budget if it's passed as is?
Nearly 5,000. And that's, again, roughly a third of NASA's remaining workforce. That would put it, NASA civil servant staff, roughly 11,000 people. To put that in context, the last time NASA had that few people working for it was before the first American launched into space. So, you know, the mid-1960. So that's an unprecedented level of decline. In the context of what this budget also calls for is NASA pursuing one of the hardest things a space agency can do, which is land humans on the moon. But then adding on top of it, the hardest thing possibly a space agency can do, which is send humans to Mars with the smallest, again, not just the smallest budget since 1961, the workforce of fiscal year 1961, which is late 1960.
That was a staggering comparison that you made the last time you were on the show here. When adjusted for inflation, this budget is the closest to the 1961 budget. And as you mentioned, NASA and this administration wants to put people on Mars, which is a very, very ambitious thing. We may not be able to know this from the proposal itself, but what is the motivation behind these cuts to science? And why does this administration think that with these cuts, really big programs like humans on Mars could even happen?
There's not a lot of justification provided. And to the extent that it is acknowledged, it's tautological. It just says, we can't afford this anymore, so this is low priority. Well, they're the ones deciding we can't afford it. They took an arbitrary number, lopped it off of NASA. And, you know, from everything we know, right, this is not some considered output of a policy process. This is not some strategic realignment. This is a budget-driven decision. It very closely aligns with the White House Budget Office Director's original proposal for NASA science from 3 years ago, which is to cut it in half and to cut NASA by 20-ish percent, which is, you know, again, pretty much what happened. So, you know, clearly it's not reacting to changes in need for NASA or even changes in the budget fiscal realities that we're facing now, because it's pretty much exactly what was proposed years ago. And it's being dumped to NASA. NASA had no seat at the table in this discussion. So everything we see, again, this is not a smart policy. This is just an arbitrary number. NASA has to work with it and serve, I guess, the president's the standard goals of getting humans to Mars, which in abstract, I would be excited about. I think it would be fantastic. But the cost of this is so high in terms of the decimation to other NASA programs. But also, there has been no effort to sell this idea in any form to Congress, whether Republican or Democrat. And the first Trump administration knew very well you have to get consensus for these human spaceflight programs.
Okay, so let's talk about the process now. This is a budget request from the White House. Where does it go now? And what does the outlook look like in the coming days and months throughout this budget process?
In a, you know, kind of idealized process, you would have the appropriations committees in the Senate and the House consider the budget, hold hearings with the NASA administrator to understand the administration's proposals. The Congress would, you know, through these appropriations committees, write these bills for NASA with knowing about how, you know, how much money they're going to spend, as Congress does, you know, through a budget resolution process, pass them through each house, reconcile them together, send them to the president by the start of the fiscal year, October 1st. That process hasn't occurred that way since, you know, the late 1990s. You know, it's always been a bit delayed, but it's particularly difficult given the gridlock and the other policy challenges facing Congress right now, a very, very closely divided Congress that will make it very difficult for Congress to actually, you know, even if they write draft bills, to pass them into law in time to really offset some of the consequences of this budget going into effect.
You are quite intimate with what happens on the Hill. What do lawmakers think of this, including some lawmakers who have generally been quite friendly to NASA and space programs?
I don't think anyone's excited about this budget. And that's, you know, there's a lot of quiet grumbling. We've heard dead on arrival from Republican and Democratic congressional offices. You know, there's enough to dislike for pretty much anyone. If you're Ted Cruz, this cuts back on the ISS research and ISS operations, cancels Gateway. If you're in Alabama, you lose SLS and you lose Orion. If you're in Colorado, you lose a lot of lunar capability and planning and business case. If you're a commercial company that was betting on the U.S. staying at the moon for extended periods, you have broad cuts to education, you have broad cuts to science, you have cuts to aeronautics. You know, no one is excited about this. But again, will that be enough to be able to offset this if Congress itself broadly, and it's not because people like or dislike this budget, but the broader political trends, if they're unable to act in some coherent manner, this budget basically gets implemented by default. So it's no one likes it. There's very little effort to defend it. And again, even if they pull it off this year, what I'm very worried about is in a few years, if another party, if the Democrats take control in Congress or the White House, or even another Republican in a few years, if there's been no effort to make consensus on this radical shift to Mars after over anything else, that probably won't continue. So it'll be, again, they're taking Artemis, which they had put a lot of work to build consensus in, to make it an enduring project, survived a presidential transition, the first time any project to return to the moon has survived presidential transition. And they've unlearned that lesson with this budget. And they're proposing a radical shift in terms of human spaceflight policy at great cost to other parts of NASA that will not survive in the long term if this continues without an effort to build consensus.
Casey, you say it's difficult to defend, but I'm going to try to with a question here. You know, would some folks say that with this much divestment by the federal government in the agency, that leaves room for the private sector to step in and come through? Could that be a possibility with this? Will the private sector be able to make up for this? And does this give an opportunity for the private sector to do that?
You know, one of the joint letters that the Planetary Society organized standing against these cuts was co-signed by industry coalitions like Commercial Space Federation. The government is their primary buyer. You know, no private organization is just generously giving their own money to do space science. You know, Jeff Bezos will fly himself into space, but he has yet to pay for a mission to Europa or a mission to Neptune. And the reality is that the things that the government does, you know, uniquely, right, that we have a public space agency for, fundamental science, fundamental research, exploration, these are the things that the project is actually, or this budget actually divests from, and is investing in things that clearly at least private individuals, if not the private sector, are already interested in doing, right? Elon Musk going to Mars, commercial space stations in low Earth orbit or commercial activity in low Earth orbit. To some degree, private industry has already been pursuing that. So it's the opposite of the policy you want of NASA doing its unique capabilities, doing what the private sector can or won't do. And then at the same time, not, you know, cutting back on what it will buy and invest from and undermining and you know, under-investing in the very market it pertains to depend on. It does make claims that it wants to incorporate private commercial launchers for future lunar and Mars missions, but there's zero information about what that looks like, and it's not even clear how many companies will have the capability, the financing, the infrastructure, the technological, wherewithal to participate in that beyond just a handful of them, right? So it's a very uncertain outlook if you are a private company with this budget as well.
Finally, Casey, you mentioned NASA had no seat at the table during the drafting of this. Elsewhere in the show, we've discussed the removal of the nomination of Jared Isaacman to be the head of NASA by the Trump administration. Does that make it even more difficult for this budget process moving forward for the agency, for it to not have a permanent leader during this process?
Absolutely. This is the worst time it could have pulled a NASA administrator. I mean, Jared probably was not super excited to inherit this budget that he didn't have a hand in putting together. But there's no internal advocate now within the White House for NASA's interests. And there's no empowered leadership at NASA to really be able to push through initial change or dynamic. It's all split up and divided within the White House through this relatively opaque policy process that we're seeing. And absent this empowered leadership, NASA will be at the mercy and the whims of the budget office, of whomever else is creating these ideas and giving it to the space agency and saying, make it work.
Casey Dreyer is the chief of space policy at the Planetary Society. Casey, thanks for joining us once again.
Anytime.
Still to come, a space news roundup. Trump's NASA nominee is out, and SpaceX's Starship took flight for the ninth time.
While they appear to have solved one issue with the upper stage relighting its engines, they sort of had another problem later in the flight with tumbling. of the vehicle, and obviously they eventually lost control of it and it had to self-destruct.
That's ahead on Are We There Yet? You're listening to Are We There Yet? I'm Brendan Byrne. What would happen if the Earth became uninhabitable? Well, that's terrifying to think about. Our planet, sun, and even our universe have an expiration date. We just don't know exactly when. But we do know when we'll talk about it. Our impending doom, that's next week on Are We There Yet? But for now, we're talking the latest news from the space beat. Just days before the Senate was supposed to vote on the next NASA administrator, Jared Isaacman, President Trump withdrew his nomination. Plus, just last week, SpaceX launched its giant rocket Starship again for its 9th test flight. So what's ahead for NASA's vacant administrator role and the future of Starship? Well, here to talk more about these stories is Eric Berger. He's a senior space editor at Ars Technica. He's also the author of two books, Liftoff and Reentry. Eric, welcome back to the show.
Thanks very much. Good to be here.
Good to have you this particular time. It's been a very busy time on the space beat. Story that broke over the weekend. The Trump administration has pulled its nomination of Jared Isaacman for NASA administrator. What do we know about this?
Well, we know lots of things, I think, that are pretty important. First of all, I do believe this is a huge blow for NASA. Even if you didn't like Isaacman or think that he was a good choice, and to be clear, I did. I thought he was going to be really good for the agency in moving it forward. This sets back the nomination timeline by months, likely, and sort of leaves them leaderless at a time when the budget is being cut significantly with a great amount of uncertainty hanging over the space agency. So that none of that is good. The other thing we know is that it was done not because of Isaacman's qualifications or because he had not been approved by the Senate committee. He was 19-9. It was done for political reasons.
What are you hearing from the space community about this?
The space community is by and large pretty upset. Isaacman has done a lot of public speaking in the 5 years since he's gone to space and really kind of emerged on the scene. He's really a class act, from donating hundreds of millions of dollars to charity, to cancer research, to going out of his way really to reach out to the space community and let them know that he's a true believer and really in this for the right reasons. He has a pretty broad base of support. And, you know, I have a number of Republican-leaning space people in my orbit, so to speak, and they were all pretty excited about Isaacman becoming administrator, and so they're kind of shaking their heads, wondering what happened and why it happened this past weekend as well. So I think there's just general disappointment, both for the fact that Isaacman was well-liked, kind of younger, energetic, and really was coming to NASA at a time when it needed to take a step forward to modernize.
And as you mentioned, this leaves the agency leaderless for an extended period of time because this process takes so much time. And the budget proposal that came from the Trump White House looks to slash NASA quite significantly. I know this is all speculation moving ahead, but I mean, without a leader there to advocate for NASA, what happens with this budgeting process?
One of the key things about getting an administrator in was that it would be a counterweight to the budget. So to date, basically, NASA policy from the White House and certainly the budget has all entirely been driven by the Office of Management and Budget. So that's Russ Vought and his team. They've been consistently cutting science funding across the board. It's not just NASA. And so they will continue to sort of drive the process forward now. And so it will really be up to Congress, Senate and the House, you know, when they take up the president's budget request and set the final budget for NASA later this year to establish their priorities for the space agency. But, you know, not having someone to talk to them, like the Senate was planning to have a budget authorization hearing, I think, next week, where Isaacman was going to testify. I mean, now I don't know if it's going to be Janet Petro or they're going to delay that, but like not having him in place is just really very bad for NASA at a time of high uncertainty.
Mm-hmm. Janet Petro being the interim administrator,
yes,
right now.
Yes.
Finally, on this topic, Eric, are there rumblings, rumors? What are you hearing about who could possibly be that next nominee for NASA administrator?
Well, very quickly yesterday, I heard from four different people that the likely choice was going to be a retired Air Force general, Lieutenant General named Stephen Quast. The Trump White House hasn't said anything. And, you know, given how turbulent this whole process has been, changes are possible. But he's an interesting candidate. He comes from the Air Force, obviously, but has thought long and hard about sort of space flight, space supremacy, is very interested in commercial space, you know, ultra low cost launch, also very concerned about China's interest in the moon and activities on the moon. And so I think he would be a strong advocate for lunar landing. And he's well liked by from the people I talked to about him yesterday. However, it does concern me because Quast is from the Air Force, the nominee for deputy administrators from the Air Force, and the chief of staff would be from the Air Force. I mean, NASA is a civil space agency. It's not an offshoot of the military. It's not part of the Space Force. It's supposed to be conducting peaceful exploration and sort of be a beacon for cooperation in the U.S. government. So that does give me a little bit of pause about Quast.
Yeah, there's some great reporting on the pulling of the nomination and some of the things that you've heard from folks in the space industry you wrote over the weekend for Ars Technica. So definitely check that out. I want to turn to Starship now. SpaceX launched a Starship on its 9th test flight. But before that flight, you had a chance to chat with Elon Musk about kind of expectations for this and what the program is looking like as it moves through this iterative design. What did you glean from that interview with Elon Musk ahead of that Starship flight?
Well, you know, it's interesting. I've talked to Elon a fair bit over the years, and he did seem to me like he was the old Elon again, in some sense, kind of focused on solving big problems and mission oriented at SpaceX, you know, at times funny, at times serious. But I got the sense that he realizes that Starship is this, you know, hugely ambitious problem to solve and that there are going to be setbacks along the way. And I suspect he was hoping for more than what happened with the test flight. But at the same time, I think, you know, there's a recognition that they've still got a lot to learn and a lot of problems to solve before they really get a rapidly reusable rocket.
So let's go to the flight, Eric. What went right? What went wrong?
So, I mean, it's really hard to get away from the fact that they had a major success with the first stage, right? It's pretty remarkable that they reflew successfully a first stage that had flown a couple flights ago. And it'll work, right? So now SpaceX is still the only company to refly a first stage from a rocket, and they've done it, you know, multiple times with Falcon 9, Falcon Heavy, and now Starship. So that's very impressive and promising for the future. I think more concerning is the fact that while they appear to have solved one issue with the upper stage relighting its engines, they sort of had another problem later in the flight with tumbling of the vehicle, and obviously they eventually lost control of it and it had to self-destruct. They've got a long way to go, right? Because just landing Starship in the ocean is one step to get to. But then, you know, when I talked to Elon, his major focus for this test flight and near-term test flights were getting the heat shield correct. Like, he told me they had a dozen different experiments on board the vehicle in terms of the size of heat tiles, the shape, the gap filler, the distance between the tiles, and just all these different things to try to sort of nail the reentry. Because obviously Starship was going to be reaching orbital velocity and coming back to Earth's atmosphere, similar to the space shuttle. And they want the tiles to be much, much more reusable than we had with the space shuttle. And so they're really experimenting. And when they're not even getting that data because they have to destroy the Starship in orbit or in space, that's not great.
Is that concerning with so much riding on Starship for NASA's Artemis program and also for the financial future of SpaceX with launching Starlink satellites? I mean, the fact that they haven't even been able to get data back or conclusive data back on those heat shields because it hasn't returned successfully. I mean, is that a concern?
Yeah, I mean, I think it is in some sense. So you mentioned financial stability. I mean, I was in South Texas. I saw the Star Factory that they built there. I mean, they are spending a lot of money. They clearly have money. Starlink is profitable. So I don't think financial concerns are a major deal. However, it is a little bit concerning that we're on test flight 9 and sort of we're still having these pretty fundamental issues with the upper stage that they need to solve. And you're right, they really do want to get to launching these larger Starlink satellites with Starship. And it's a major issue for NASA, which is counting on Starship for lunar landings, hopefully at some point this decade. And they have a long regime of test flights to go through before that happens. And so, yeah, I mean, it is absolutely concerning for SpaceX and for NASA, but it's certainly, I don't think, life-threatening for the Starship program or SpaceX.
Do we know what is next with the next test flight? I know Musk has said that they are going to be coming at a much faster cadence at this point. When's the next one, and what are you going to be keeping an eye on for this?
Well, it remains to be seen when the next one is. It could be, you know, the FAA has opened an investigation, anomaly investigation, so that probably will take at least a month. So I probably wouldn't expect something before the end of July. It might even be August before they've tried again. You know, some of the key things with that flight is they're going to try to probably refly more boosters. They'll probably try to catch reflown boosters. These are first stage things. And then I think in the upper stage, it's to make sure you can get Starship flying again in a controllable manner so that you can start reentering it and getting more data. You know, a real big milestone is that they think that a lot of these issues with the upper stage will be solved when they move to the third block version, Starship 3. It's got an upgraded Raptor engine, and that should hopefully solve a lot of these problems, but they're not going to fly that before the end of this year, Musk said this week or last week. So they got a lot of test flights coming, and they're going to get a lot of data, but I think we're still a ways away from sort of seeing operational Starship missions.
Along with this test flight, Elon Musk also updated the public on his plans for Mars. Did we glean anything new on his plans to make our species interplanetary?
Not really. You know, he's talked a lot about this in the past, and was just kind of, you know, announcing an update to the timeline, but there really wasn't too much to glean, you know, other than the fact that kind of he's back in the satellite SpaceX as well as Tesla, I believe, and really trying to drive his companies forward. I think ultimately that will be good for SpaceX and NASA, but no, from his presentation, you know, we kind of got some notional timelines and things like that, but I mean, people who have been following this closely probably didn't learn much new.
And finally, Eric, again, this is a crystal ball question here, but are there any impacts to SpaceX and the Starship program with this proposed NASA budget and without someone like Jared Isaacman intended to lead the agency? What's the future of SpaceX and its relationship with NASA?
I would say that I think there's going to be a decoupling because Elon was one of the, look, Trump says he wants to go to Mars, right? But that guy is thinking about a lot of different things, and this is not a super high priority. And now that Elon Musk is out of Washington, sort of one of the main impetuses for going to Mars is gone. And Jared, let's be honest, was kind of a Mars guy as well. Like, he was really very much behind that vision, although he was certainly his own man. He wasn't beholden to Musk. He truly, truly believed that. Quast is more of a moon guy. So if he becomes the NASA administrator, I think you're going to see a de-emphasis on Mars at NASA, at least in actions. And so I think we're going to see kind of a decoupling of NASA and SpaceX. I think SpaceX is going to kind of go its own way. You know, they do not need funding from NASA like they did 5, 10, or 15 years ago to survive. They're going to continue to work with NASA. But my sense is that Elon is going to be in a mode where he's ready to show the world what SpaceX can do. And if NASA wants to come along for the ride, great. But, you know, if not, you know, he's going to Mars.
Fascinating. Looking forward to that reporting, Eric. Eric Berger is a senior space editor at Ars Technica. He's also the author of two books, Liftoff and Reentry. Eric, always great to have you on the show. Thank you.
Thank you.
That's going to do it for this week's show. If you're not already, be sure to subscribe to the show's podcast feed so you never miss an episode. Do that on the Central Florida Public Media app, the NPR app, Apple Podcasts, Spotify, YouTube, really wherever you get your podcasts. Stay connected with this show. Follow us on social media. Our handles on Instagram and Facebook are at @AWTYSpace. If you've got an idea for a future episode of the show, or you think you'd be a good guest, well, reach out to us. Our email is arewetheryet@cfpublic.org. More space coverage online, visit cfpublic.org/space. Are We There Yet is a production of Central Florida Public Media. Our intern is Ashley Reed. Our producer is Marion Summerall. Editorial guidance comes from Latoya Dennis. Support for Are We There Yet comes from our listeners. Until next week, I'm Brendan Byrne. Thanks for listening.